Now, for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the intersection of wildlife and civilization, the story of the cougar in Colorado and points east. It's quite a fascinating story. Earlier this month, a cougar showed up in Omaha, of all places. It was captured not far from one of the city's busiest intersections. Local wildlife officials think this lion and others that have been spotted in western Nebraska may have come from a known population in the Black Hills of South Dakota. In recent years, there have been reports of cougars. You may know them as mountain lions, pumas, or panthers. Reports in several Midwestern, Southern, and Mid-Atlantic states. All signs, some say, that the cougar is migrating east, or more accurately, returning to the eastern U.S., where its range once stretched from Canada into the Carolinas. Today, the only established cougar population is a Florida panther population in the southern part of that state. This hour, for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about whether the cougar really is returning to the east, and we'll talk about the cougar's homecoming to Boulder, Colorado, just over a decade ago, and how the return of the native forced residents and wildlife officials there to rethink the way they managed wildlife and wild animals on the modern frontier. If you'd like to join us, a number 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. David Barron is the author of The Beast in the Garden, a modern parable of man and nature, out this month, just out this week, by W.W. Norton & Company. He's a former NPR science correspondent and now a visiting scholar at the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University in Massachusetts. And my pleasure to have him back here on the program. David, welcome.
Thank you, Ira.
Also, this is another Dave. I'm going to call David Barron Dave, and this David, so you can name them differently. Is David Mayer is the author of The Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore, published by Island Press. He's also an associate professor of conservation biology in the Department of Forestry at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, and he joins us today from member station WUKY in Lexington. Welcome to the program, Dr. Mayer.
Glad to be here, Ira.
All right, let me ask Dave here first. Do we have misconceptions about us being the predator? Are we the wildlife? Are they the wild? Who's the wildlife here?
Right. Well, all across the country, there are problems cropping up with wildlife in the suburbs. And what you hear from everyone is that the problem is that we have moved into wildlife habitat. And that's definitely true, but that's only half of the story. We are also luring wildlife into our habitat. All the deer, you probably have deer in your yard,
yes,
in Connecticut.
Yes, I do.
It's not that you have put your house where the deer were. We had wiped out the deer across most of the East 100 years ago. Mm. The deer have come back, and suburbia is perfect deer habitat. And what happened in Boulder was the same thing. People created perfect deer habitat, so the deer came into town, and then when the lions returned in the 1980s, the lions, which eat deer, followed the deer into town. We are luring wildlife to where we are, as well as moving to where they are.
And, David, there was a famous case about someone who was eaten by a lion for
right,
the first time in 100 years.
Exactly, and that's sort of the central story of my book. In 1991, an 18-year-old named Scott Lancaster, a high school senior in Idaho Springs, Colorado, about a half hour from Denver, went for his normal afternoon jog behind the high school, didn't come back, and it took 2 days before his body was found, tucked beneath a juniper and still guarded by the mountain lion that had killed him. And that was, it shocked not only the local community, but it really shocked the scientific community, because mountain lions were not thought to be that dangerous. The idea that a mountain lion would attack a full-grown human being in the middle of the day, a couple hundred yards behind a high school, in view of an interstate highway, it was the attack that was never supposed to happen, and unfortunately, we've had several similar incidents since then.
And this was the return of the mountain lion.
Exactly. I mean, mountain lions never were gone from Colorado entirely. They were never gone from Boulder entirely, but they were bounty hunted in Colorado and all across the country until the mid-1960s. And after the bounty was lifted and they became a game animal that can still be hunted but in a regulated way, the lions came back and they found people living mm-hmm. where they used to be.
All right, we're going to talk lots more with David Barron and David Mayer. David Barron is author of The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature. And David Mayer is author of The Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore. And we're going to come back and talk with both of them right after this short break. So don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking about wildlife-human encounters this hour with my guest David Barron, author of The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature, out this week, published by Norton and Company, and David Mayer, author of The Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore, out by Island Press in 1997. David, let me continue with that story, because it's an interesting story about the child that was killed
right,
by the mountain
actually
lion.
18-year-old, a young adult, yes.
Yeah. What happened? Why were they so surprised? Should they have been so surprised, the townspeople?
Until 1991, until the death of Scott Lancaster, generally, if you'd asked biologists about mountain lion behavior, you would have heard that they are timid, elusive creatures, mostly nocturnal or active at dusk and dawn. And to the extent there were any attacks on record in recent years, the victim was always a child, which made a little more sense that a mountain lion might go after a child as prey. Or the lion was somehow deranged, it was rabid, it was starving. And so the idea that in this case a perfectly healthy lion would attack a full-grown and athletic person,
right.
Scott Lancaster was actually training with an Olympic cycling coach, and he was jogging this route every day because that was part of his training. And the idea that a lion would go after a full-grown human in the middle of the day was a shock. However, getting to your question, there were warning signs, and that's a lot of what I write about. In the three or so years prior to Scott Lancaster's death, the lions, we now know, were basically habituating to people. They were losing their fear of people. They were starting, perhaps, to associate people with food because they were moving deeper and deeper into town, following the deer, and then they started eating people's dogs and cats, hanging out in people's yards in the middle of the day. They were exhibiting behaviors that mountain lions weren't supposed to exhibit. And I believe that really what happened to Scott Lancaster was a direct result of what was happening in Boulder in those 3 years beforehand.
Were these people moving into the lions' territory? Were the lions coming back to where they once lived?
Well, the lions were coming back to where they once lived. They'd been pretty much gone from that area for perhaps 50 or 100 years. So, sure, that used to be lion habitat, but New Jersey used to be lion habitat. Maine used to be lion habitat. Yeah. This entire country was. So it's kind of a question that's unanswerable. Whose habitat is it? It's both of ours.
Dave Mayer, you studied the Florida panther, another name for a cougar. Have there been any encounters between panthers and people there?
None that have resulted in death or even attacks that I'm aware of. Of course, we can discuss the benefits of mountain lions killing cats and dogs, but in Florida, it's not a problem.
And why is that, do you think? Why do you think it was a problem in Colorado but not in Florida?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the landscape. It has to do with the animal itself. The panther has a history of being somewhat more demure, a little bit more shy than other mountain lion subspecies in North America. They're not quite as aggressive, just as big. Their diet is the same. They're certainly capable of killing people. But another factor is people tend not to spend time in the deep mosquito-infested swamps where these animals live today.
What is the status of the Florida panther these days?
They're listed by the state of Florida and the federal government as an endangered species, and their population is somewhere less than 100 all total.
Have they tried to reintroduce panthers or mix them with cougars from other states?
Well, there have been some interesting experiments going on. They have been merged, if you will, with cougars from Texas in efforts to forestall genetic problems that would crop up in the near future if that small population continued to be isolated. And it's caused some interesting things. The population has increased in number for reasons we're not quite sure of. And part of that has allowed animals or forced animals out of that population. We've had animals that have left the South Florida area and moved as far north as the outskirts of Orlando. People don't see them. They don't eat dogs. They don't eat cats that we know of. They certainly have left people alone. And it gives us a lot of hope that there may be potential for animals expanding out into parts of the wilder areas of Florida.
David Barron, I guess in order to understand how it came to be that cougars were attacking people in Boulder a dozen years ago, you have to understand the history and the stance toward open space and wildlife.
Exactly. Boulder is has really been a pioneering community in protecting open space. Back in the 1960s, Boulder decided to tax itself. The voters passed a a sales tax dedicated to preserving open space. And so over that began in 1967. By the mid-80s, Boulder had surrounded itself with thousands of acres of parkland, which had been ranch land. And when it was ranch land, there was hunting. The deer were hunted. The mountain lions were hunted. But it turned into parkland where there was no hunting allowed. That allowed the deer to come back and the deer then to move into town. And then for the lions to come back and the lions to move into town. And this is a problem that's now cropping up more and more as many communities are starting to rein in development by buying up parcels of land. And the Nature Conservancy has bought up more land than New Hampshire and Vermont combined in open space. We have lots of now these essentially wildlife refuges that are right next to very dense urban development. And that's a big part of the problem, too, that as the wildlife is coming back, we have this very sharp edge between where the wildlife lives and where the people live, and that's causing a lot of conflict on that boundary.
And if you don't allow people to hunt the animals, then there's no way to call out the animals who are just feasting on the deer and other things.
Well, right, and this is now a huge issue in New Jersey, where the black bear population from 1970 to today is up like 30-fold. There were about 50 or 100 black bears in New Jersey in 1970. Now there may be as many as 3,000. They've been causing a lot of problem in suburban areas. Now there are plans for a hunt in New Jersey, and that's very controversial. So these are not easy problems to solve. Hunting is probably part of the answer, but that's not going to solve the problem in the suburbs because you're not going to allow bear hunting in the suburbs.
But can we, David Mayer, bring some cougars up over to Connecticut or in our suburbs where we have too many deer and have that control itself?
Why not stop? Don't stop there. Get wolves too. That may help solve the problem. But
you're serious. I mean, people might think you're making a joke about that.
Well, in part, part of the reason that we might have a problem in the suburbs may be that we don't have wolves. We don't have the full community of carnivores that were originally there. Certainly, as we see areas that might be home to these carnivores, there are people there that say, "Look, we succeeded in getting rid of these things 200 years ago. Why do we want them back?" My guess is the bigger challenge is overcoming the social resistance to restoration as opposed to the biological ones. These things certainly can make it in many parts of the East where they're absent right now.
Right, and I want to point out, despite the fact that my book is about a fatality, the risk of mountain lion attacks is extraordinarily small. Now, it's a lot higher now. It's become a lot higher than it was as recently as 15, 20 years ago, but the numbers are still tiny. And, you know, there are a lot more people killed by deer every year. More than 100 people die each year in automobile accidents caused by deer. At the rate we're at now, there's about one death by cougar every 2 years. So reintroducing cougars into the East to reduce the deer population may actually save lives.
Would wolves be a better idea?
Well,
you're not going to win any election saying I'm running on a platform of putting some wolves in the suburbs.
I want to agree with Dave Mayer that part of the problem of what has happened in Colorado, I believe, and I write about in the book, is the absence of wolves. Historically, mountain lions have been afraid of dogs. In fact, mountain lions are normally hunted with dogs, and it's believed that that's because in evolutionary time, the mountain lions lived with wolves, and wolves were the main enemy of mountain lions. Well, the mountain lions in Colorado have lived without wolves for generations, and they've now figured out that dogs make good prey. And so the dogs now have been luring the lions into backyards as well, and that's part of the problem. If we had wolves, that may actually keep the lions in line a little more.
David Mayer?
And for whatever reason, wolves do not have a track record of killing people. And Dave, I think you maybe have done more research on that, but I'm not aware of any records in the East, and there may be none in the West.
Right. Unfortunately, there have been a number of fatal wolf attacks in Asia and in Europe. But in North America, right, at least in the last century, I know of none.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Michael in San Rafael, California. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Why in the past 15 years do you think, even though they've been moving closer to residential communities, why would they be acting up all of a sudden? Or you've explained some of that, but can you go into possibly more detail?
Yeah, has the growth occurred so greatly just in the last 15 years?
Yeah, well, because until the 1960s, all across the West, there was bounty hunting. And I think it took probably a good 10 or 20 years for the lion population to really grow. And the problem seemed to be cropping up in different areas at different times. It was Boulder, Colorado back in the late 80s. Missoula, Montana had a spate of lion problems in the late 90s. Orange County had several serious problems and a couple of children attacked back in the mid-80s. It's hard to say why any given community has a problem with lions that suddenly crops up. But it may be only a few problem lions that are you know, causing the problems in any given area. And if those particular lions are dealt with by wildlife authorities or sometimes by a private individual, then the problem will go away.
Yes.
Okay, Michael?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ben in Oklahoma. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, how are you? Go ahead.
I'm calling because I live out in Oklahoma, as I mentioned, and my uncle has a ranch probably about 20 miles north of Oklahoma City, and a large adult mountain lion makes her habitat. And I was wondering, he looked up, and I guess they did a large release a few years ago of about 50 cats in the area. And what the average size of a range of one of those cats would be?
David Mayer, you got any idea?
Hundreds of square miles. Out there, we may be talking a female, maybe 100 square miles at the most.
Well, he says these are about once a week or once a month.
That's very reasonable. You would expect that. It sounds like it indeed is a resident animal. They make a circuit through a home range. A male may visit its entire home range once a week. Make a circuit through it. A female takes a little bit longer, particularly if it has kittens.
What was there a release in Oklahoma? I mean, I know we have a lot of natural wildlife here. I had coyotes living in my backyard at one point.
You know, I'm not aware of any releases that have happened there, and I'm just wondering if that's growth from nearby states into your state.
Yeah, I know of no release in Oklahoma. I think they're just spreading across the plains,
right,
basically from Colorado and New Mexico.
So those wouldn't have been Texas cats, then? They would have been probably Colorado cats?
Could be Texas. I'm not sure.
Hmm. Yeah, I suspect you're probably correct. They're probably coming from the west. I mean, in Texas, they're more to the south and far west.
Do they have big belt buckles on? We'll
10-gallon hats.
My friends in Texas will appreciate that. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
1-800-989-825. When we were in Texas, we'd go to Texas a lot. I learned it's not the cowboy hat that's the big thing. It's the belt buckle. My friends in San Antonio tell me that. We go out to San Antonio a lot. One of the interesting things about your story, David Barron, is that you write that even though the cougars were attacking animals in Boulder, there was still a great deal of support for protecting the cougars.
I mean, absolutely. Well, again, Boulder is filled with environmentalists and animal rights activists. That's part of what makes Boulder so special, is that it's protected its natural environment. But there was a sense when the lions came back that we should be grateful to have them around. And I live in Boulder much of the time, and I am grateful to have lions around. But that doesn't mean that we should let the lions just have free rein. Mm-hmm. If a particular lion is showing signs of dangerous behavior, I think that lion needs to be dealt with. But back in the late 80s, when it still appeared that mountain lions were virtually harmless, Boulder basically had the policy of just leave them alone. But Boulder has learned its lesson and now is more active in managing its lions.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this hour about cougars. Colorado, Florida, eastern U.S., maybe you've seen them in your neighborhood on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And we said at the beginning, you know, it sounds like they're just about everywhere. Originally, they roamed almost everywhere.
Absolutely. They were the most widespread mammal in the Americas. They lived from British Columbia to Patagonia, from coast to coast, in rainforests, in swamps, in deserts, up mountains 14,000 feet high. They're incredibly adaptable. So knowing that, it really shouldn't be a surprise that they can adapt to suburbia, and that's what they've done.
Mm-hmm. David Mayer, what do you make of all these recent reports of cougars in southern, midwestern, and eastern states? How much truth do you think there are to these sightings?
Well, I think the ones where they have a carcass in their hand are quite convincing, and particularly when they have white-tailed deer remains in their stomach. They're showing up in southern Illinois, in Iowa, in Missouri. And those are real phenomena. I think they're coming from populations that are expanding from the West to the East. Whether they succeed in colonizing this part of the world remains to be seen. And then there's a whole other cadre of people that believe they're already here. Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, on up the Appalachians into New England. There are people that believe they are here. And I just heard of a report this morning from someone that heard of a rumored cat in South Carolina.
Are they hard to find? I mean, do they come at a certain time of day or night? Or
well, if an animal lives in a particular area, it should be possible to find sign, whether that's footprints, which are very different from dogs, scats or kills. There should be some way that that animal makes its presence known. And the problem here in the East is there are lots of animals out there, but they don't leave those kinds of signs. So it makes you wonder what kind of cats these really are. I'm being a little sarcastic here, but there are these phantom cats.
Well,
it's interesting. There's a wonderful desire to have them back here. There's tremendous support to bring them back or to encourage their return.
But there's no plan to reintroduce them.
No, but you know, interestingly, the eastern cougar is listed as an endangered species by the Fish and Wildlife Service, even though it's by and large considered extinct. But that keeps the door open for doing something about it when they show up on their own.
Right, although, Dave Mayer, I heard you speak at a conference a few years ago, and I believe you proposed the idea of reintroducing them to Kentucky or Tennessee.
Yeah, I think my point was if you had to pick a species of a group of large mammals, whether it be elk or black bear or mountain lion, which one would you get the biggest evolutionary bang for the buck? And that would be a mountain lion or a wolf. And that would be from the reasons that you've already discussed with too many deer in the backyard. We've got a bunch of dumb and unwary deer that don't know what a predator is. And those animals could make a lot of changes in how people's backyards, gardens got eaten and create a new tension or return an old tension to these landscapes.
Do you actually find that you can make these pitches? Is it possible to go to a community, you know, and say, hey, listen, I know you think this is a little nutty, but this is the real truth, you know?
Well, there's organizations now. For example, the Eastern Cougar Foundation. There's a group of citizen activists who not only want to bring these animals back, but also spread the word, also educate people. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is trying to improve the wildlife and ecological IQ of Americans again. I mean, we have really lost touch with the outdoors, and it's some special event for us to go back and enjoy the outdoors. But there's some interesting things happening out there that we really have kind of forgotten about as a population.
Right, I agree. And I think we as a nation have gone from an unrealistically negative view of predators as being evil, destructive creatures that we should get rid of, to I think we've gone too far the other way, to think that wolves and mountain lions are harmless and we should just have them around. We need a realistic view of what they are.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back with David DeMayer and David Barron. David Mayer is author of The Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore. David Barron, author just out of the book The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature, Norton and Company. Stay with us. We'll take your questions after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about cougars, pumas, mountain lions. Take your pick. In Colorado, Florida, eastern U.S., maybe coming to a town near you. My guests are David Mayer, author of the Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore. David Barron, author of The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's see if somebody else has seen a cougar in their backyard. Hi, Elias in Jackson, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question, and that was my father-in-law lives about 20 minutes west of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and his property is against a very large tract of state land. And just this past spring, he's an avid turkey hunter, and he swears up and down he's seen a cougar in these woods that are, you know, just behind his house. And there is a lot of room, and we have seen quite a few coyotes deer hunting, but I haven't seen it. You know, the cougar and no one else around the area has really seen anything, but, you know, I have to tend to believe that he's seen something. And I just was had a question of what were the possibilities of an animal that size being in this part of the country?
Well, if I could answer, it could be a mountain lion. Actually, right there is some evidence of mountain lions in Michigan. The evidence is somewhat controversial, and there's more research being done looking into it. But there's some decent evidence that there may be mountain lions there already. And if there is a mountain lion, even if you live in mountain lion country like Boulder, Colorado, you can live there your entire life and never see the lion. They are so secretive. And if you do see it, it may just be a quick glance. So on the one hand, it could be a mountain lion. On the other hand, reports of mountain lions are notoriously full of errors. Many people who think they see a mountain lion really see a large house cat or perhaps a golden retriever, or it's a bobcat or something else. So it's hard to say.
David Mayer, how do you know you've seen one? What are the tracks? You mentioned some of the things they leave behind before.
Normally when someone actually has seen one of the first things that they say is, I just saw something huge, gigantic. And they will exaggerate the actual dimensions, but that is always part of an accurate description.
Right, and they'll often talk about the size of the tail as well, which is huge.
Quite impressive. Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind is even if there weren't reputable evidence of a potential population in Michigan, these things can disperse 200 to 300 miles from their birthplace, and so they can really get around. And so it's possible they could show up almost anywhere.
Does that description fit what you saw, Elias?
Yeah, my father-in-law said he was out doing his normal turkey hunting early in the morning. And he was walking into his spot, and him and the cougar looked at each other, and they both turned and ran the other way.
That was a good reaction, I think, on both of their part.
Happy turkey hunting, and thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-90.
Keep that one.
Keep
that one in the gene pool.
Keep that one in the gene pool. But you know, when we have a deer in our neighborhood, we worry about things like Lyme disease, the ticks, and things like that. You don't have that with a cougar, I guess, hanging out.
Well, you may also have the Lyme disease. I mean, Boulder now has mountain lions and deer. Frankly,
right.
The deer population is still really big, and there's. It's not clear to what extent mountain lions really do reduce the deer population. And actually, I'd be interested to hear what Dave Mayer has to say about that. Bringing the mountain lion back, I don't know how much good it will do in controlling the deer.
Has anybody tried that, David Mayer?
Well, I think what the potential is, the potential benefits are that mountain lions or panthers help redistribute prey. And what deer will do is go to places that they're less likely to be killed. And if that happens to be around suburban areas, they may retreat back to places where there's more cover, places mm-hmm. that they can escape better. And there's evidence that this happens in South Florida, where bobcat, panther, and deer partition the landscape in such a way that deer minimize potential encounters with something that's going to eat them. So they learn pretty quickly. And elk, the same way. Moose in Yellowstone, we've seen the effects of wolves coming back to the Yellowstone system. These predators really do some significant ecological and behavioral work out there.
Mm-hmm. But I guess to bring them back east, it's going to be, I guess, more or less a selling job on your part or anybody else's part, more than anything that would restrict them naturally.
Yeah. It's either going to be a selling job or they're going to do it on their own. And mm-hmm. What will have to happen is states will have to get ready for it. Colorado has done a wonderful job in recruiting perhaps the leading cougar biologist in the country, Ken Logan. They're going to be prepared to deal with this situation as it changes, as it improves or declines. Other states may have to do the same thing, gear up with people that really know what these animals do and how to manage them.
Pete in Boise, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing?
How are you?
We just had a cougar sighting on our green belt about 2 weeks ago. I'm an outdoor mm-hmm. writer, so we did a hit-rated front-page story. And even though we're out in the boonies, it's still surprising to have such a big predator come down right downtown.
Right. Well, it shouldn't be a surprise anymore. That is happening all across cougar country. I mean, we've had them in Boulder, literally downtown. There was a paw print found at the corner of 9th and Arapahoe, which is solidly downtown Boulder. So the Greenbelt, if it's in the Greenbelt now, it may be a little deeper in town next time.
Well, Fish and Game told us that they're actually, you know, we do have a great deer population right downtown, and they, I mean, down along the Green Belt and the river and everything, and in the foothills. And Fish and Game's theory is that the cougars are following the deer into, you know,
city
limits.
Right. I think that's absolutely right.
Any way to entice the cougar? Just have a big deer population? Is that what will bring them?
Absolutely. There have been many studies of what cougars eat, and usually about 80% of what's found in cougar scat or in a cougar's stomach is deer. So that right. they will follow the deer.
Thanks for calling, Pete.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. John, and is it Du Bois, Wyoming?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just wanted to relate to how hard cougars are to see. Unless they're moving, you're not going to see one. But I had a nephew that who's big game guide for years, and he was walking through some timber, and he said the first thing he saw was the eyes about 10 feet from him. He said he couldn't even see the animal. He just saw the eyes. And he said there was really nothing between him and it and the cougar. And he said, you know, it was so well camouflaged and sitting there, and it didn't seem to be going to, it was just crouched down, so he kind of tried to back away from it, and it stayed there pretty much and watched him walk away. But
what do you do? What is the recommended thing to do, David Mayer, when you see a cougar? Just back away like this?
Yeah, I had one encounter that was potentially dangerous, and it was a female with kittens, and we surprised each other. The female actually did come after me for a few steps, and I backed away and maintained my cool as best I could, and ended up being able to turn around and walk away. But that cat was motivated to protect its kittens and not eat me, so I lucked out in that sense. But I think in 99.9% of the cases, the animal will be more afraid than the human. And generally what happened in this example happens most of the time.
Right, and also, if you actually see a mountain lion, you're probably okay, because mountain lions, like all cats or most cats, are ambush predators. They want to attack you when you're not looking. And so it's really the lion you don't see that you have to worry about. And so my main advice for people who want to go hiking in cougar country is don't go alone. If you go
exactly.
with someone else, the odds of being attacked are so vanishingly small. And if you are attacked, there are many cases where a companion will come to the aid of the person who is being attacked and kick and punch the lion, and it'll give up. Mountain lions want an easy kill.
Hmm.
And as soon as they get resistance that's substantial, they will back off.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I was just going to say, one, he had a little deer antler with him, and he dropped it on the ground when he first saw the cougar, and he had some pepper spray. But then when he decided it probably wasn't going to jump, he crouched down to get the antler, and it got really tense then.
Yeah, not a good idea to crouch.
Stood up and backed away. It relaxed again.
Why is it? Let me just remind everybody. I'm Irv Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. David, why is it not a good idea to crouch?
Well, you don't want to make.
I'm just an Easterner. We
sure,
don't.
Of course.
We haven't seen a cougar yet. We have coyotes, but no cougar yet. But I want to know these.
You want to be as big and imposing as possible, so you want to stand tall, and crouching, bending over, makes you look a little more like typical prey, like a four-legged animal. You don't want to do that.
And perhaps threatening as well, getting in a crouch position. It may think you're getting ready to spring.
You know, I remember that from my old Boy Scout manual somewhere. They talked about. No, they had it if you come. Remember those in the old, I don't know if you're a Boy Scout, they had the manuals what to do if you meet wild animals and spring or crouch or hide or stand up or something. I'll have to go dust that one off. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones, get some more cougar stories. Randy in Tulsa. Hi, Randy.
Hello, how are you?
Hi there.
Hey, this is a fun story, and it's good to hear all these things. And I've had encounters with cougars directly and indirectly through other people, all the way from northern New Mexico down through Texas and North Texas near Wichita Falls, Archer County, and now here around Tulsa, I hear stories of people seeing a mountain lion dragging a deer up into a tree to drape it over. And the most interesting one was a man crouched down hunting, making deer noises. And it wasn't the sun wasn't quite up yet, and he got attacked from behind by a cougar or a mountain lion, and he said he basically crapped in his pants and screamed like a girl, and the thing ran away. And
I didn't see that in the Boy Scout manual.
No, but he didn't know if it was the odor or the noise that ran it off, but he sure surprised it. And but a whistle works really well. And my kids carry a little deer antler made into a whistle.
Well, actually, I mean, I know of cases where loud noises have been tried to scare lions away, and it doesn't do a thing. I mean, fog horns.
It's not
horns,
like bear. When you're in a bear neighborhood, you try
to
make
noises. It may depend on the individual animal, but loud noises have, in the cases I've heard about, have not been very effective. And the best way to scare off a mountain lion, give it some negative experiences, is to shoot it with beanbags or rubber buckshot out of a shotgun. And that's what's done in Boulder now. If a lion is hanging around too close to people, it'll be hazed in that way.
David Mayer, what should we do with mountain lions in the suburban areas? How should we handle them?
Well, I think that'll be the challenge of Ken Logan and others, but I think we would agree that where you have an animal that has sort of abandoned its respect or fear of people, it should probably be removed. And and I'm talking about lethally. That animal should be shot and killed. Unless there's some home for it in some sort of a zoo-type attraction. But I think you need to eliminate those individuals that might pass on genetic tendencies or behavioral tendencies that would encourage more of that kind of thing.
So don't approach these animals like the kids.
Well,
not
as a layperson, no, yeah. Absolutely not. But I think David made a good point. If you see the animal, it's probably seen you already, and it's on its way somewhere else. When they're in town, when they're hanging around people's backyards, I think that's a situation that that the agency folks should be allowed to take care of.
All right. I want to thank both my guests this hour. David Barron, author of The Beast in the Garden, A Modern Parable of Man and Nature, out this month from W.W. Norton. He's former NPR science correspondent. And he's visiting scholar at the Knight Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. The Beast in the Garden, a fabulous book. I highly recommend it. It's a good read, especially if you like it. It's a story you're not going to expect, so it's very interesting. David Mayer, author of The Florida Panther, Life and Death of a Vanishing Carnivore, out from Island Press in 1997. He's also associate professor of conservation biology in the Department of Forestry and the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Thank you both for joining us this hour. You're welcome.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Earlier in the hour, we spoke with Miguel Nicolelis of the Center for Neuroengineering at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today, as always, and we always need it, from Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020, or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. If you missed any of the links we talk about, Charles has them up there for the whole week, and also Science Friday's Kids Connection in there, free curricula, free teaching materials that we make out of Science Friday. Also, there's real audio archives of Science Friday, and you can also download back editions and take them away on your Audible player and listen to them whenever you'd like. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Have a great weekend.